All right, welcome, Dr. Julie Spray, for our Q&A. So, Julie, you all know, is the author of The Ethnography, The Children and Child Health, which is a revised version of her PhD work that she did at the University of Auckland. And maybe I'll just let Julie, I'll let you give a little introduction to your background and then what you're doing now, and then we can get into, because we've only got the hour. Because I know the students have to get off to Judith's class, some of them. We'll get into
Judith.
it.
Say hi to
Yeah.
Judith for me.
Okay, we'll do.
Hi, everyone. It's really awesome to be here with you, although I cannot see or hear any of you at this time, and I'm just imagining what you look like. So my background, I was a University of Auckland student the whole way through. So I did my undergrad, a BA conjoint with the Bachelor of Fine Arts. And my major of my BA was in anthropology, which was largely because I was originally going to major in psychology, but then the psychology classes clashed with all of my fine arts classes. And so I needed to find another class to take. And so I started looking through the calendar, and anthropology starts with an A. And so that was pretty much the first thing I found was Anthropology 102. And I took that paper and loved it. And never ended up taking a single psychology paper, and look where anthropology ended up taking me. So I went on to do my master's in biological anthropology. I don't know if you guys know Bruce, but he was my main master's supervisor along with Judith. And then I kind of transitioned across into more social anthropology, or really medical anthropology, and did my PhD at Auckland as well. And since then, I have done a stint working as a research fellow, also for the University of Auckland, but up in their School of Population Health. And then from there, I've taken up a postdoc in here, which is Washington University in St. Louis School of Medicine. I'm in the Department of Surgery, of all things, which sounds super like not like an anthropologist, where an anthropologist should be, but I'm actually in the Division of Public Health, which sits under the Department of Surgery. And so I'm currently working on a project to do with childhood asthma. The project was originally, or is, focusing on caregiver experiences of caring for a child with asthma. And it's particularly interested in sort of how caregivers assess risk or understand risk and manage children's asthma in social contexts where there's a lot of racial and economic disparities. And so I've come in to do the qualitative analysis for that project, and I've been writing a lot of papers. And I've also been running a kind of sub-project, which is looking more at children's experiences, because of course, they never begin by looking at children's experiences. So I was doing an ethnographic project, and we got almost halfway through that, and then COVID hit and the world was cancelled. And so we've now been trying to pivot to an online variant, and struggling a little bit with recruitment because, frankly, children aren't that inspired by asthma, and it's been harder for me to get kids involved when I don't have that face-to-face contact with them where I can kind of sell it to them a little bit. So working through some challenges, but that's where I'm at.
Great. So I think we will do, maybe we'll start with the questions that were submitted in advance and make sure we get address those. And then those of you who are here, if you've got additional questions that come up as Julie's talking or ones that you didn't submit before. So I've got questions from Rena, Michalina, Lisa, and Carissa. So we can start with Rena's question. So I think this is one of the ones that I had sent you before, maybe, Julie. She was asking about if you think children's conceptualizations and understandings of rheumatic fever can be applied cross-culturally. So are they applicable to other illnesses in other cultures, or do you think that they're unique, the result of their unique circumstances, lack of resources, lack of information, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question about how we can generalize findings. And so what I would say in general is that some of the particularities of rheumatic fever and the particularities of children in these circumstances in New Zealand may be somewhat unique, although I would imagine there could be similarities, say, with Australia, for example, where Indigenous Australian children are also disproportionately affected by rheumatic fever. But I think what's really generalizable is some of the processes that I identified and some of the ways of thinking about children. So, for example, the fact that children experience the world through a body, and that that body is different from adults. That's a universal thing. And so we could take that kind of as a lens of analysis and look at a whole huge range of different illnesses across different contexts. So for example, I'm thinking about that now with asthma in the context of St. Louis children. And one thing that I'm seeing is that asthma is a chronic illness. And so often for kids, they've really grown up with it and they've had it for as long as they can remember. And so while adults can kind of assume that asthma is like when kids get asthma symptoms, that is an out of the ordinary event. Actually, for a lot of kids, that is ordinary. That's just kind of normal for them because that's all that they have experienced. And so what we can see is just a huge amount of accommodation that children will make for asthma symptoms. So to the point where they don't even realize that they're struggling to breathe because struggling to breathe is so normal for them. Mm. So that's an example of how some of these processes can be transferable and malleable across different contexts.
Mm. Yeah, so that makes it really useful that you could potentially pick up those who've been reading the ethnography, think about those processes in a different setting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking about it now with COVID as well. Mm-hmm. Like all of these things, the embodiment, the way that children produce knowledge through social networks, the way that children take knowledge from the kind of public arena and the public health messaging and use those to understand themselves and their position in society and their risk. All of that is happening now with COVID in very, very similar ways.
Mm. So moving on to Michalina's question, make sure we're getting through these. Yeah, this is the one where she asked if you enjoyed writing and putting the book together and thinking about people reading and studying your work.
Oh, I love this question. I think this is a pretty unusual situation in that I wasn't writing a book, I was writing a thesis. And writing a thesis is quite torturous. Like, it's really, really hard. And so I wasn't actually thinking about people reading it. I was just thinking about finishing a PhD. And it had never really occurred to me that it would end up being almost exactly how it is as a book. So I didn't really enjoy putting it together as a book. There were parts of it that I enjoyed about doing the thesis, but mostly it was really stressful because I was worried about, you know, not being able to do it. I think it would be more fun the second time around. But the process of putting it into a book was really unusual for me because usually you finish your thesis and then you do your revisions, you graduate with your PhD and then completely rewrite it for a book because just most theses aren't written in the same kind of genre as a book would be. And I just like totally cheated by doing a find and replace and changing every instance of thesis to book. which, by the way, if you ever do that, watch out for the word synthesis, because I did get a syn booked that kind of got caught up in there, which thank goodness no reviewers ever picked up on. And then I was just so busy with everything else that going through the publication process was just a blur and a rush. And there are lots of things I wish I'd taken more time over and done differently. But it's my first book, and the next one can be better.
So Lisa had a question about participant observation with children. Do you think it was harder working with children, you know, getting attached to them over the course of your field? Like, I'm not sure how long your field work was, and then how did you explain what you were doing to them?
Yeah, my field work was just over a year. I started off actually in a kind of volunteer role in the school, just kind of scoping the situation before I formally started the project. So I already had built some relationships with the kids beforehand. I write in the, I think I have in the appendix a little bit about how I sold the project to the kids. Or did, am I imagining that? I feel like I wrote it up somewhere. Or it might be in the introduction or something. But basically, I have a way of talking to kids about, do I do this?
Your appendix was about the drawing.
Yeah. I wonder where I put that. I remember writing it somewhere. So the way I like to sell research projects to kids, I guess, because you do really have to get their buy-in. And as we know from the kind of school lunches, but just because you want a kid to do something doesn't mean that they're going to do it. So I like to start by talking to them about what anthropology is, and what it means for children. And so I use the story of Myra Bluebon Langer's work. She did a project with children who were dying of leukemia back in the 1970s. And her work has been enormously influential. And so I talked to kids about how this lady called Myra wanted to understand what it was like for children who were dying. And that all of the adults thought it was best that children don't know that they have cancer at all, or that they're dying. And so all of the adults were trying to conceal this from and hide this from the kids. And then I'll say to the kids, what do you think about that? Do you think that was a good idea? And they'll all say, no. And I'll say, why? And they'll go, oh, you know, they might think of things. They'll come up with really interesting things. And I'll say to them, do you think that maybe the children actually did know a bit more than what the adults thought? And they'll go, yes. and I'll sort of sell it to them as this like thing where adults think they know all this stuff about kids and they make all these assumptions, but do you really think that adults know everything about kids? And so we're kind of co-conspirators there, where this is the kids' opportunity to correct adults and tell them the real truth. And then maybe we can use that information to help other kids in the future. So you can see why I'm having trouble with this process doing online stuff, because I don't have kids in front of me to have this conversation with. And then I talk to them a lot about what research means and what I'll be doing and what their rights are and how I'll protect them and all that sort of stuff, and that they can do it or not do it. And then they'll go off and do the consent stuff. So that's the kind of introduction to the project. But I'm a big believer that research ethics isn't just something that happens as a singular event at the beginning of a research project and then you're done with ethics, which is unfortunately often the way it's conveyed, especially by ethics committees. But ethics is this ongoing process of negotiating consent and boundaries and all these sorts of things. And so I write about that in chapter 3, and about the particular challenges of doing fieldwork, not necessarily with kids, but doing fieldwork with kids in a school where we have all of these structures and all of these power structures, particularly around adults and children, that govern the way that adults and children relate to each other, and that those are not particularly conducive to doing ethical research, and how challenging it is to negotiate those ethically, and some of the particular challenges that I had that I was kind of having to figure out on the fly. And these are things that ethics committees, like, you just never write about that or predict that as part of that process of going through the ethics application, because they're unpredictable. And then the last bit, like, did I get attached to the kids? Yes, of course. Like, I loved those kids very much. And they were very attached to me as well, which made things very complicated and it made me worry about my responsibility to them. And especially after the project ended and what would happen with those relationships, and do I need to take more responsibility for offering kids the opportunity to continue those relationships after the project was ended, or is that too far and would that be unethical? But yeah, I have a paper in mind that I really want to write about love in fieldwork, and especially because there's so many rules governing how children and adults can love each other, and who is allowed to love each other, because you know there's safety issues, of course, with that. And so what happens when you have these relationships of love between researcher and participants who are adults and children? And is that a bad thing? Is it a good thing? Or what are the challenges there? But yeah, there was a lot of grief for me leaving the fieldwork, because it was the end of the school year. A lot of them were going off to their next school, like they were heading off to intermediate, or they were moving schools. And I didn't know how much I would be back, and it did feel like an end. And kids kind of forget you pretty quickly as well, to be honest. So when I came out of the fieldwork, I did a lot of artwork to kind of process that grief and memorialize those kids, and that's actually ended up being what one of the cover image is. That's a picture from my process of working through the grief of losing those kids. And one thing that happened later, which was incredibly sad, is one of the kids actually died about a year after I finished my fieldwork by suicide. And that was really heartbreaking for me, because I'd been writing about suicide in the book, like, and I knew that was going to happen. I didn't know which child, but it was just the level of risk that those kids were at and what the statistics said. I knew it was going to happen. And so it was really hard for me to have that knowledge and just be able to do nothing about it and just watch it play out and hear, oh, it was this kid who is one of the kids I write about in the book. So he was somebody that I had paid a lot of attention to. So yeah, these are really complicated issues with participant observation with kids that were really unexpected to me.
So as did you end up going back at any point later when you finished the thesis, or
I write in the conclusion, I think, about how I went back about 6 months after I finished fieldwork and just kind of checked in and caught up with where everyone was at. I also one of the teachers also died, so there was a lot of death. And so I went to her funeral and saw a lot of the kids there, and I went to the tangi of the boy who died as well. Actually, I drove one of the other kids down to that tangi because I wanted him to be able to grieve his friend. So I had a little bit of informal contact, but actually a lot of people changed in that school very, very rapidly. There was a lot of turnover, and so I think only one of those original teachers is still there, the teachers that I worked with, and there's a different principal now, and obviously different, all the kids have changed.
Entirely different group, yeah.
Yeah, it's not the same place anymore.
So do they know that you've published it as a book?
A couple of the teachers I'm in contact with on Facebook, and so they know, yeah.
Be interesting if that, you know, they have it in their school library or something like that. Yeah, you know,
I was going to send a copy to the local marae, but so Rutgers sent me a bunch of free copies, but I actually wish they had sent them to New Zealand, because I can't afford to send them home. So I'm just sitting on all these copies that I can't give anyone. But eventually I'll pass one on to the marae. The school does have a copy of the picture book that I made
Oh, right. Yes, I remember that book.
Yeah, so I gave one to all of the teachers and one to the principal and one to the library, the school library. So they do have that, which is more sensible, really. It's much more accessible.
So question from Carissa. She says, why do you think, despite childhood development being such a crucial period in personality and health development, that children tend to be only sort of indirect focus of studies on health and health inequalities?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting paradox with children, because public health research is both obsessed with children and also ignores children completely. So, I'm in public health now, and I see this all the time with the kind of presentations that come through our division, where children are kind of treated like they're kind of treated like livestock. Like, I sort of sit there and think, you could swap children in the study out for cows, and it would not meaningfully change the study, because they're just being treated as bodies and kind of passive. There is a discrepancy in which children are the focus. So both in terms of sort of ethnic and socioeconomic disadvantage. So a lot of disadvantaged kids are targeted for studies, but also in terms of where in childhood. So you get an awful lot happening at the early childhood stage, and then a lot happening at adolescence. So early childhood, because it's understood that that's the time where a huge amount of development happens, which it does, but it's that really physical and kind of brain cognitive development. So they tend to overlook that enormous period of development that happens during middle childhood, because that development is so much, like, that's real social development. And I think health just kind of disregards that as being part of health. And then, yeah, you get that big focus on adolescence, because that's perceived as risk, a risky time, and it's a time of transition, and it's the time where kids start to become humans almost. And from a public health perspective, of course, because younger than that, you know, they're the responsibility of their parents, but they're not fully adult yet. And then as to why that happens, I mean, I think that comes back to the way that our society constructs childhood, and sees children as kind of innocent, but fairly passive and incompetent, rather than as fully formed human beings who have their own experiences and their own practices, and aren't just entirely under the control of their parents, but do stuff. So something that's really interesting to me is the way that public health conceptualizes responsibility with children. Mm. And I'm writing about that with asthma at the moment, because so asthma, did you guys have a lecture from Susanna about asthma and self-management?
Maybe the students can answer. She did 3 lectures. I'm not sure if she talked a lot about asthma specifically.
I'm seeing a thumbs up from Carissa.
Okay. You can see I didn't attend those lectures.
Sorry if I was catching you out there. So self-management policy with children is entirely predicated on the assumption that the caregiver is the proxy for the child, and that they're fully responsible and fully in control of everything that happens. And that's just not the case. For a start, like, children are the ones who experience the asthma symptoms, and so often they have a huge role in actually identifying when they have symptoms and either taking medicine themselves or notifying a caregiver. The caregiver can't tell a lot of the time. And that's just completely overlooked in self-management policy. Like, there's nothing in there about what children's roles should be in their asthma management. And so I've done a lot of interviews with asthma care providers, like pediatricians and pulmonologists and stuff. And often I ask them how they conceptualize children's roles in asthma management. And they're just kind of like, huh, I never really thought about this before. Or they're very vague, or they have this kind of ad hoc philosophy, but there's no model of how do we include children, the patient, in asthma care until, you know, maybe late, like teenagers. And that's just really telling of how invisible kids are in public health, and how many assumptions we make, and how much work there is to do about challenging those assumptions.
Yeah, I found the same thing with HPV vaccination when that was rolling out. So during my grad studies, I was doing an independent study looking at teenagers and young adults' perceptions of the vaccine. And the one thing that struck me is that all the literature was about the parents' decision-making, as if and then when I was looking at what the adolescents were saying, they're like, no, my mom left it up to me to decide. Or it was a joint decision, you know. Mm-hmm. It was like, what do you think? And it was, the parents were not doing all the decision making. They were either delegating that to their, obviously, you know, their adolescents that they thought were competent to decide for themselves at what point they wanted this vaccination, or it was sort of a joint negotiation or conversation at least. But the literature was entirely on parents. And I thought maybe it was what you were saying, but I was also wondering if it was partly, at least from the literature standpoint, that ethics with children is tricky. And it was just so much easier for them to do a study on parents' perceptions than to go through the additional ethics work of talking to people under the age of 16 or 18 or whatever their ethics form said required sort of additional work.
Yeah, maybe, except that, like, I mean, I don't know how representative this is of IRB, so that's ethics, here in the United States, but it was so easy to get our child study through, the child asthma study through. Like, we just submitted it as a supplement or a modification, and it was, like, the next day approved, and I was just like, how is this ethical? It's not. Like, compared to what I had to go through at Auckland, like, and I mean, people complain about ethics applications at Auckland because they take a lot of work, but they should take a lot of work. Like, this should be a rigorous process. This should really make you think and challenge you to consider what the ethical issues are. And I'm actually quite appalled at the ethics processes here. They're not about producing ethical research. They're just about, you know, kind of covering the university from legal implications. So, like, quite frankly, any public health researcher in this country has no excuse not to include children in their study, because it's really easy. I think it's just that they don't know how to. And also, again, just like, it's never occurred to them to, because people just carry all of these assumptions about kids and they don't think that they're important. Which means that we're the people who have to keep writing across the public health to show them why they're important.
I also wondered if it was partly that most of the authors were adult males, and they're writing about perceptions of children's, you know, girls, at that time with the HPV, adolescent girls' decisions about vaccination. I was like, been an adolescent girl, and maybe there, you know, some lived experience of how that process had gone, perhaps would have been helpful. But one more question from Carissa. In your book, you talk about personalities and how different children reacted to hardship. Do you think this is part of what's missing in health advertising and policy, is understanding how different children respond to health inequalities? So maybe sort of the varied possible responses, and maybe rather than a sort of monolithic.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because you're right, like, some of the kids were pretty unfazed by that health promotion messaging, whereas other kids, and then kids who were bothered could respond in quite different ways. Like, either they could become hypervigilant and go to the clinic a lot, or they could get really avoidant. I think definitely. And that's a really good point for me to think about, because I've just been asked to consult on with the county's Manukau District Health Board on developing a child-centered throat swabbing procedure, I haven't been to the Hui yet, so I'm not really sure of the details. But that's exactly the kind of thing we need to be thinking about. So yeah, thank you for pointing that out.
Great. So that's, unless, I'll keep an eye on the chat in case any thoughts are coming to you, questions for Julie. But in the meantime, I sort of thought of a few questions. I think I'd sent those to you, Julie. I think you already talked about one of them, which was other examples of co-productions of health and changing habitus. You talked about asthma potentially. But is there anything else that stands out to you about sort of that changing habitus angle? I was thinking, as I've been reading the U.S. news the past year or so, like the effect of active shooter drills on children, and how that changes their bodily experience or their psychological, states or development, like thinking of always being vigilant potentially, or thinking of, because I've read some stories about children, because they're trained now to think of hiding places, to think of securing the door, securing the windows, so that when they walk into a classroom, instead of it just being a room where you learn, it's where's the closet? Where's the place where I hide? Does the door lock? Are the windows secure? Can I get out them? And thinking of my own experience in school with earthquake drills, is that sort of, you started to think about, could I get out? You started to scan the classroom, and that's not even as really a visceral, the earthquake drills were sort of like they play rumbling sounds on the loudspeaker, and most of it, it was not very realistic. It was enough that your imagination would kind of go, okay, but none of us had ever been through a major earthquake. We didn't have that trauma, and we didn't have, but the U.S. active shooter drills, they have like really realistic simulations and training. And so that impact on the children must be, so is there anything like that or anything else that you sort of think, oh, how is this changing children's bodies or day-to-day practices or?
Yeah, I'd love, I've been wondering about that active shooter thing myself and wondering if anyone is, like, what kind of research is being done with kids on the experience of these drills, because I think you're right, like, not only are these extremely intense and visceral, but they're coupled with this almost, apart from this year, constant media highlighting of the reality that this keeps happening to kids and I mean, that's an awful thing for kids to have to go through. It makes me so angry. I definitely think stuff is probably going on there. The other one I've been obviously thinking about a lot lately, apart from asthma, is COVID-19, and how dramatically this is restructuring childhood in so many ways, like from caregiving arrangements to schools to social relationships, but also in practices of the body. Like all of a sudden we've got hand washing, we've got mask wearing, we've got physical distancing, and like for kids are so touchy. Like proximity is such an important way of expressing relationships and connections and feelings. Like all of these processes, and I mean, you guys are super lucky because you're at level one and life is pretty much going back to normal. So it's kind of a short-term thing for you, although I wonder what kind of lingering effects there might be for kids. But here, we're going to be in this situation for probably years. I mean, even with me, I've got a partner who's very vigilant about hand washing after I've touched a doorknob of our apartment complex. And it was very, very quick for that to become a habit, to the point where, like, now I can't do anything until I've washed my hands when I've come into the apartment. And I wasn't even trying. Like, he just made me do that with just some repeated cueing. And so I can really see how, especially because this is a formative period for children and young people, how these kinds of things may carry with kids for a really long time. In terms of practices of the body, but also other effects as well. I was talking to my colleague the other day about how we have quite a large segment of the population who are maybe losing grandparents who wouldn't have already ordinarily died. And grandparents are so important for kids, that especially among the demographic who are losing their grandparents, where grandparents are often fulfilling really important caregiver roles. Mm. And just, I can't even begin to imagine what the collective impacts of that could be for a generation of kids. Mm. Like, it's just enormous. And it's sort of similar to what Jean Hundleth, who actually is my colleague here, what she writes about in Zambia, where with HIV AIDS crisis, it was a whole generation of kids losing their parents. They often still had their grandparents, but it absolutely changes the social relationships and the intergenerational relationships and the way those relationships are structured in ways that have an absolute plethora of effects, and continue on with the next generation and the next generation. Mm. So yeah, it's really, yeah, I can't even fathom what it's going to be like for kids. Mm.
So the other thing that was been in the news recently was the increase in rheumatic fever cases in New Zealand, and especially in the areas around Wellington. I mean, that must obviously be disappointing for you personally, having studied that and having seen, you know, the intensity of the rollout of the throat swabbing, and to see cases actually going up right now. So what were your, you know, initial thoughts when you sort of read the news story about that?
Yeah, I mean, initial thought is like, well, of course they're going up because the root problem hasn't been addressed. We still have these terrible inequities. And if you target kids with antibiotics, but you don't deal with the root cause, like, nothing's going to change. Mm-hmm. But then I was actually listening to Ashley Bloomfield when he was doing his COVID update, and one of the media asked him a question about rheumatic fever. And it's like, I haven't looked into it enough to be sure, but what he was saying was that the numbers in Auckland are actually pretty much the same. That's where the most numbers are. Mm-hmm. The numbers in Wellington, and there was one other region, I can't remember what it was, they were really small numbers to begin with. Mm. And so one of the things with rheumatic fever we have to be a little bit careful of is when we're dealing with relatively small numbers, mm. An increase in numbers can just be kind of statistical chance. It might not actually be statistically meaningful. Mm. And so, like, I think he was saying that one of the regions, it was usually about 2, and this year it was about 9. And so when you're dealing with that small number of cases, that could just be a random fluctuation. So we'll have to see what happens over the next months and years to see whether that's actually a trend that's trending upwards, it's a change, or it's just something random.
Yeah, I was wondering if there would be an effect of this lockdown, because you've got the interruption of the normal throat swabbing, plus mm. people are probably staying indoors more than they would at home, yeah. more than they would. And I was wondering if maybe we might see an up, you know, cases linked to that particular period of time.
On the other hand, kids aren't at school picking up germs from each other. Mm. So yeah. like, they may be spending more time in crowded homes, but if they've got less risk of exposure to the strep A bacteria in the first place, maybe we would actually expect to see fewer transmissions. Yeah, it could go either way, I think.
Yeah, a bit of a natural experiment, maybe. So hopefully I'm sure that people may be keeping an eye on it at some point. Somebody in public health or at one of the universities who's doing some of these long-term studies, I bet they're looking at that. Maybe one last question before we get to trying to get your questions to the students, if anyone has any thoughts. So what's it like in the US in the midst of COVID-19? You talked a little bit about it, but as a medical anthropologist, is that helpful to have that lens on things right now? Or is it too immediate to really be, you know, thinking about it in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've gone grey in the last 3 months. Like, it's actually, I mean, it's not just because I don't have access to a hairdresser. It's been fascinating to be here, but also very scary. As a medical, it's really frustrating to me in some ways because I'm a medical anthropologist, but all of my time has been bought and paid for by another project, the asthma project. And so I don't have actually time and resources to do any kind of research on COVID. But at the same time, I don't know if I would want to, because A, because like everybody's doing it. But B, because it is hard when you're in it. And so it might be more something that I think about in years to come and kind of look forward, reflect back on what's been happening and look forward for what we might want to change in preparation for future incidences of either pandemics like this or other large scale global health crises. So I'm currently co-authoring a piece with a colleague, with Jean Hunleth, about children and childhood and COVID-19, where it's a bit more speculative, but kind of considering some of these questions. And so that's been good to do, but I had to take vacation time to do it. But yeah, I think the thing that has been most interesting has just been the contrast between the United States and New Zealand, who are really like opposite ends of the spectrum. And so that experience of kind of experiencing both, although New Zealand was kind of remote, I was listening to a lot of the Jacinda Ardern, Ashley Bloomfield updates, partly because it was really therapeutic, actually, and seeing a lot on Twitter and keeping up with the news and stuff. But in the United States, we're in a situation where it feels like we're being systematically gaslit. Primarily by the president, into feeling like, well, firstly, COVID isn't a thing. It's a hoax. It's not a big deal. It's basically the flu. Okay, it's more than the flu, but we've got it under control. And then chaos is normal. Oh, and death is to be expected. And this is just the way things are. Nothing could have been done any differently. And now we're living in this situation and it's just become quite normalized. And absolute lack of clarity, lack of singular national response is the kind of norm. And we don't know anything about what's happening. And all the figures we do have are contested for political reasons. It's like there's two different realities, probably more than two. And so it's been really interesting, but also personally useful for me to come back to New Zealand and be like, oh, okay. It's not that I was going crazy and feeling like my reality was not matching the messaging that I was hearing. Like, this is a really serious concern. It makes sense for there to be extreme public health measures. That communication around those public health measures can be really clear and consistent. Everyone can be on the same page and kind of buying into this. The media are serving an important job, and also the Prime Minister has an important job, and that job, like, she has been hired by the people of New Zealand to do that job, and she takes that job seriously, and including when it gets hard. And part of that job is working with the media to put this communication out rather than seeing them as an enemy. And so it was just like this enormous reality check. And I think something that has been also really interesting for me is just like how different the kind of windows of acceptable risk are in the two different countries, where, I mean, I'm sort of laughing at New Zealand sometimes and how seriously tiny risks seem to be taken when it seems like you guys have nothing really to worry about. compared to here, we're just like, I mean, millions of people are out protesting. So, and I was protesting 3 times last week. So I'm just basically like, well, I definitely have COVID now. Good thing I'm coming in to talk to you before I start getting symptoms. I mean, that's not really true, but it feels like it's inevitable that I'm going to get sick with this disease, and there's kind of nothing I can do about it. And that's the general sense of a lot of people here. Because that is kind of the reality. There is no other plan. And then it's really upsetting to see how many people don't have health insurance. So like, for example, my partner, Simon, has a job currently working at the hospital that's attached to the medical school that I work at. He's working in the kitchens, and he's the only white guy who is there among the porters and the kitchen staff. And none of his colleagues have health insurance, despite the fact that they are working full time in a hospital during a pandemic. They don't have insurance. They don't have sick leave. What's going to happen? And so their kind of sense of things is like, well, we're going to get sick and there's nothing we can do about it and it's going to be bad and we're just going to keep coming to work because we need to pay our bills as long as we can. Work can't make them go home. Like, the policy is that if you have symptoms, you shouldn't come to work, but because of privacy reasons, they can't actually force people to go home or disclose that they're sick. But they also aren't giving any incentive for people to stay home. Mm-hmm. So what happens? Everyone in that kitchen is going to get sick at some point. And that's just like, it's such a big contrast to how it's been managed in New Zealand. Now, I know New Zealand hasn't been perfect, but oh my God, it has been about as close to perfect as you can get compared to how it has been here. Like, it's just a completely different league. So yeah, I may end up writing about that contrast at some point, because it's like disorienting to try and make sense of.
Yeah, I think that was the big difference that I see, is the recognition in New Zealand that there were structural factors that made New Zealand vulnerable, especially for Maori and Pacific communities. And then knowing what, you know, the consequences of not acting, and then not accepting those consequences.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, in contrast with the American response. And so in both cases, you've got structural factors that ideally you would address so that you didn't have those risks pre-existing any potential pandemic. But if you do have them, be aware of them, and then hopefully, if those things matter to those in power, then you can put in place actions that take those into account really seriously. So I don't know if anyone wants to chime in with some of the questions from Julie. Otherwise, I'll keep them up for the remainder of the, like, we're in our last week of the semester here, but we've got, obviously, Canvas will stay up because we've got another 2.5 weeks before their final exam, or final assessment. So I'll leave that up in the discussion forum for students to respond. But if anybody wants to respond now, you're welcome to stick your hand up. Because one of the questions you were asking was about their own experiences and whether things in the book resonated with them. And I think we'd had, you know, I think the students have been really interested in the whole issue around lunches and stigma and things like that. Was there anything, Julie, yourself that really resonated with you particularly, that you thought back to your own childhood?
I think the power structures between adults and children was the thing that I really felt, especially because I was in the school and I could see them, and it was just very visceral being in the school as well, because I had all these things I didn't even realize would be so triggering, but stuff like just the smell of a classroom. Classrooms smell the same no matter where you are in the country, it seems. And it just kind of really brought me back to that absolute, and this is really what has drawn me to the anthropology of childhood in the first place, I think, is this real empathy that I have for kids and their social position and that huge power discrepancy and how easily that's abused. And yeah, just seeing it play out in front of me in schools, like some of the stuff I saw, which I couldn't write about, but it was really appalling to me just how okay and acceptable it was to treat kids like that because they were kids. Like the amount of yelling that went on with some teachers more than others, but I was really shocked. Like, I don't think you should yell at kids like that. I don't think you should yell at anyone like that. If you wouldn't do it to an adult, you shouldn't do it to a kid. But I think some of those classrooms could have been really traumatizing to kids. I was traumatized by them. And just the way that they kind of triggered memories of me being in a classroom with a similar teacher who yelled a lot. But yeah, it was just, some of it was frankly quite abusive.
So Carissa, I think, wanted to chime in. I can see she's got her video on. So Carissa, did you want to respond to Julie's question?
If it's someone's on the discussion page, there's just a couple. I found it interesting and quite frankly a bit shocking to read about the amount of schools. When you were talking about the school lunches, and that government policy doesn't really have something to supplement a lack of lunches in certain schools, because obviously this, I guess, quite privileged background that I came from. When I was living overseas, we had canteens in every school that I was at. And so whether a child, or either you packed your lunch or you got food from the canteen, but there was always like an option there. And looking overseas, that's quite common for a lot of schools to have canteens. But then when I came back to New Zealand, I noticed that there wasn't any. And the options that they had in comparison were tuck shops, which often didn't really have the nutritional value that you would get from a school lunch. And not only did I find that shocking, but I also felt it was wrong, because there's something so important about having those meals, just to not only is it a time to socialize or to like be around your peers and stuff like that, but you need that food in order to think properly and anything like that. And that was, I just don't know like what you would think about why is there the reason that NGOs in New Zealand are focused on doing that, but then government isn't looking, well, I don't know if it's changed, but government isn't looking at doing that at the moment, and why, although the NGOs are helping out with it, you end up with lunches that are cold sandwiches
that are milk.
It doesn't seem right.
Thank you for that. It's really nice to engage with a face as well. And I think that it also just kind of brings us back to that point I was just making about COVID and how different what is acceptable can be in different places, and that something that is shocking to you is normal to me or normal to many other people. And at what point, there's a concept called the Overton window, which is sort of like a window of social values in society, and what range of things are seen as acceptable or moral or okay within a given society. And that window can fall in really different places on the spectrum in different places. So with New Zealand, now I understand that actually the government has recently brought in a new school lunch policy. I think for deciles 1 to 4, they're going to be providing free lunches. I don't know when that's going to start. It might be 2021. So a lot of the advocacy work that some of the people I talked about, I talked to them after I wrote the thesis, some of the advocacy work, it sounds like it is making a difference. But you're right, like, this isn't okay. There's a huge body of evidence that says that children really need lunch at school, and it has enormous impacts on not only their kind of nutritional status, but their ability to concentrate and their social status and all sorts of things. Like, lunch is good. We know this. So why isn't this government policy? It comes back down to this insidious notion of who, or this insidious question really, of who is responsible for children, and this idea that, this very neoliberal idea that parents are responsible for children, not governments, and certainly not the taxpayer. And, you know, I take a very explicitly political stance in the book, particularly in the conclusion, where I'm just like, this is wrong and this is how things should be. But there are people who see it differently, and think if kids don't get lunch, that's their parents' problem. And if we start supplying them with lunch, it will just incentivize parents to not bother giving their kids lunch, which kind of begs the question of, okay, so what happens to those kids? And the answer at Turama School was that those kids go hungry.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's okay.
I think that's something I definitely learned in Med Anthro throughout this entire course, and I'm really grateful, is that if the system doesn't work for people, then, like, how can, like, what they're doing kind of becomes hopeless because there's nothing to bridge the gap.
Yeah.
And that's definitely something I noticed with COVID-19, was like the difference between how governments that were actively working with the public's perception of the illness as well, and the researchers' perception of COVID, worked better in, like, how New Zealand was doing it, because of the fact that there was kind of like a united front, whereas looking at Brazil and the US, and it was really sad because I grew up in Brazil, so seeing like what's happening over there is just really sad. The disconnect between like the government saying like, oh, this isn't happening, and then what the actual reality is for. And like, it's sad because you see these mass graves being digged and everything like that, and that massive disconnect between the two, it's almost as if like there's a, it's like a silk screen or like a glass house that's being built around the government.
Yeah. And the fact that the enemy isn't COVID, the enemy is the political opposition.
Mm-hmm.
I think what New Zealand did really effectively was make the enemy COVID. And New Zealand was really clever in the way that it hooked, I don't know who did this, but whoever did the health promotion strategy, the way that they hooked into New Zealand cultural values. So the whole, like, the rugby metaphors were everywhere, right? And that worked so well because everyone wants to be on the team of 5 million working together, but not giving up before we get to the full-time whistle. And the sense that we are a kind of collective who have this enormous challenge and it's bringing us together. Like, that was really skillful, the way that they did that. And yeah, you're right. We don't see it at all in the United States. And unfortunately, Brazil is in a really dire situation now too. Go medical anthropology. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Paying attention to the people's human perceptions of things is critically important. We've run over time, I think. Hey,
Heather. Yeah, you've seen the students have to run off probably to Judith's course. So I guess we'll probably wrap up there. I just noted Lisa was talking about her experience with food in Italy. That was, you know, the building might be leaking and cold, but the lunch had to be nutritious and warm, and like the value placed on that. And I know in been reading about online the role of I think it's in Japan, the role of school lunches and other places where it's not only the eating of the lunch, their students are involved in the preparation of the lunch. So it's very different. They're not only just being served lunch, but they're doing the serving. It's part of a whole value of that's linked to, you know, wider cultural values about sort of communal responsibilities, and it's sort of seen as instilling that kind of cultural value of working together and sort of the communal responsibility, and they, you know, their cleanup, they were more responsible for cleaning the classroom and things as well. Yeah, and Lisa says had the help.
Cooking.
The cooking, which is really interesting, because I see a lot of writing about this in Asia, or in Asian cultures, but not Italy. For, you know, actually, as a comparison, it seems to always be the Asian students that are the example. But that you could, I guess, you see that in Italy as well. So yeah, very different.
And lunch is about so much more than just food and nutrition. And I think. Unfortunately, here and in other places, it gets boiled down to just its kind of function, its nutritional function. But other countries that are thinking about it more broadly as a social process, as a cultural process, like they're really maximizing the opportunity of lunches to do all sorts of work and fulfill all sorts of functions.
Yeah, shared meal rather than what we did at not my elementary school, but my high school, we didn't even have a cafeteria. We had a sort of small, tiny room where you could buy a few things, veggie sticks or something, if you really, you know, if you really needed lunch or sandwiches. But there, it was so tiny that you couldn't eat in there. So we all just ate sitting on the ground in the hallway. And I remember just thinking that that colored my perspective of the entire school and what they thought of us. You know, they clearly didn't respect us very much as students if we all had to eat our lunch sitting on the ground in the hallway. It colored my entire perception of the value of us as young, you know, adolescents in the school by the way, you know, there was no provision for us to sit somewhere and eat our lunch at a table or something like that we just had to find a random corner in a hallway.
So such powerful symbolism. And the same thing was happening with the cold bread, and this concept of like the economy of dignity. There's no dignity in having frozen bread, but there was no provision for dignity in that either. Like, that's just not something that was really being considered at all, is that the symbolics of that kind of food. And so of course kids didn't want to have that, because to accept that lunch is to accept something about yourself and your worth.
So Carissa just has one last question. What you think about New Zealand valuing of school image with uniforms and rules over well-being? Because that does come up a lot in your book about the uniforms.
It's interesting because the United States doesn't do uniforms very often.
And I think it's private schools. That's the distinction. Is in Canada as well. A uniform means you're at a fancy private school or a religious school, not a public school.
Yeah. I mean, I get that there's a lot of complexities with clothes as well. It's not easy. So like the reason why Te Reo Māori School brought in a school uniform to begin with was to stop kids dressing in like gang colors.
And I think they do that in the US as well.
So to prevent that kind of division that was occurring. And so I can't really sort of say, oh, well, you shouldn't have done that because now. But at the same time, like, these kids are too cold and they don't have enough clothes, and families struggle to pay for these uniforms. And then kids come to school and they're freezing the whole day. Like, and I mean, I remember that from being at school as well, more in high school, and just being, again, there's no dignity in that. It's even worse when uniforms are gendered. Can't be studded on skirts, because I could write a whole essay on the indignity of forcing girls into skirts. But yeah, I don't think school uniform policies consider children's dignity. I think they consider them as bodies that they are disciplining. And yeah, as you say, the image of they are bodies that are representing the image of the school.
I think it goes back to the responsabilization, sort of whose responsibility is it? It's the same thing with the lunches in a way. It's the parent's responsibility to supply the child with the uniform, rather than, hey, you're starting school, here's your uniform supplied as part of your, you know, part of what the government funds as part of your education. If you require a uniform, here's, you know, rather than the parents being required to purchase a uniform.
Yeah, totally. And I also think if you're going to have a school uniform, you need to have children's input into what that school uniform looks like. And it needs to be adequate. So, I mean, I think Tuarama school was okay. Like, they could wear pants and jackets and stuff if they had them, of course. A lot of the time they had lost them because kids do that all the time. But I remember in high school having really inadequate clothing against the weather. And it just was really unfair. Like, it wasn't well-designed clothing. If you're in a skirt and tights in the middle of winter, that's too cold. So, like, design it for dignity, design it with input from kids, and design it for the function that it needs to have, rather than just what it looks like and how it genders people and disciplines bodies. Yeah, thanks for the question. It's a bugbear of mine.
Yeah, I just noticed Cam is just logged in as we're wrapping up, but but there we go. So Cam, if you have any questions for Julie before we wrap up,
looks like
now's your chance.
He or she is still connecting.
Yeah. Maybe having some problems.
Maybe they're coming in here by accident and is actually looking for Judith's quest.
Maybe, possibly. I think we've lost Cam now, so. Okay. All right. I guess we should let you go, Julie, as well, to get back to whatever you're up to over there.
Time for dinner.
Yeah. Oh, of course it's late for you. I'll let you get home.
What about 7? Thanks everyone for coming. This was really nice. Oh, I so loved the views that people sent me through as well in response to my questions. It was really cool to hear how people were engaging with the work and what it brought up for you guys. That made me really happy. I sent it to my colleague and I was like, look what they wrote. It was so great. And I just want to apologize that the book's so long. I feel bad for you guys because the chapters are really long. I have trouble with being concise. And so I could imagine you guys kind of trying to plow through this giant piece of writing. If I'd had more time, this is one of the things I would have done differently is actually trim it down quite a lot and put a lot of that stuff into end notes instead of in the actual body of the chapter. But it was a rushed thing. So.
Well, it's nice to have I think for me personally, it's nice to have it in the body of the chapter rather than having to flip back to notes.
Yeah, I don't like end notes for that reason as well, but I think a lot of the literature stuff could have gone in notes rather than in the actual chapter.
And Chris is just saying she loves and Lisa, that they like the meaning behind the name you gave the school.
Oh, I like that. Thank you. It took me a while to come up with that.
Yeah. Great. All right, we'll wrap up. And thank you so much, Julie. It was very nice to see you again in this virtual format. So I don't know if you all know, but Julie used to TA this course as well. So
I sat on it when I first started my PhD, and then I TA'd it the following semester. And then I was a marker for it the third time around rather than a tutor. But yeah, I've had a lot to do with this course. It's been very influential, as you could probably tell from the book, because I think just about every theme that was taught in the course has ended up in the book. So it's a real
It made it perfect. I was like, Julie, this is perfect, because like it's reinforcing all sorts of different aspects of what we talk about throughout the course in other weeks. So it fits in really well.
It's a product of the course. So there we go.
Great. All right. So I'll let you go, and I'll send you any other questions or responses from students that come along in the following weeks, because I'm sure students will be reading and rereading as they head up to their final assessments. So,
yeah. All right. Good luck with the final assessments, everyone. You'll have to send me some of those exam questions. All right. See you guys. All right.
Take care. Thank you, Julie. Bye.